Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 205 of Geek Town Radio. We're back this week with Daryl. How are you doing?
Hey everybody, it's great to be back.
Good. So it's been a few weeks since you've been on, and we've had lots and lots of things happen over the last few weeks, but what have you been up to?
Not too much. The first thing is this thing that popped out of nowhere, The Society on Netflix.
Yeah.
Which is about a wealthy town, American town, of teenagers who go off on a trip to escape some strange smell in their town. And when they return, no one else is there.
Yes.
Their parents disappeared and they're basically left alone. And it's about 200 or so kids all around the same age, which seems to be like high school seniors. So
yeah.
17 or 18. And immediately sounds like another Netflix show, which was called Between.
Right.
Which was about a town where a strange virus killed everybody over the age of 18.
Oh, okay.
Right on their 18th birthday.
Right.
Obviously, other than that, they're very different.
Yeah.
Society definitely has more of a fantasy, sci-fi-esque to the plot.
Yeah.
But it's a real drama. It's real tough. I've watched 6 episodes, I think, so I have 2 more left. It's realistic. Everything that the people there do, you can understand why they do it and you can see how they got there.
Right.
It's just really realistic and it's like one of the best dramas I've watched this year easily. It's really sucked me in.
Yeah, I watched the first episode so far. I haven't had time to go back and watch the rest of it yet, but I did really enjoy that first episode. So I'm glad you've got a positive view of it.
I think it gets better from there because as the name suggests, they do turn into an actual society. You see how the effect of being alone and the acceptance of them being alone for at least the medium term starts to affect them. It stars Catherine Newton,
yes,
which you obviously know who that is because you're a huge Supernatural fan.
Yes.
And that is, of course, one of the Wayward sisters.
Yes.
And she stars as Ali Pressman. And I think she's pretty much the most easily recognizable person in the cast.
Yeah.
Other than that, there's Grace Victoria Cox, who starred in Under the Dome, another show about a group of people who get stuck inside a town.
Yes. Yes.
But that's based on the A.M. Stephen King novel. But yeah. Definitely recommend checking it out.
It's
10 episodes, and I think finished about 7.
Okay. Yeah. So, this is the thing. We've talked about this the last few weeks. It's because Matt was watching it as well. And I'd seen the first episode. It's sort of a modern take on Lord of the Flies, was the way it was pitched. That seems to be, where sort of there are no adults around, so they're having to figure out how to form a society is essentially the sort of basis.
I think it's slightly different because of the age that they don't, they tend to stay away from the immediately crazy ideas of something like that would do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it would be a very different show if it was a group of 14-year-olds.
Yeah, no, totally. But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to watching some more of that because it did look really good. Mm. And I've got some time coming up to be able to go and binge my way through some things, so that will be one of the ones that's on my list of binging things.
Excellent. And other than that, I was also making my way through Lucifer.
Yes.
That returned after its move to Netflix.
I enjoyed that fourth season. I thought it was really good fun. They used their Netflix accessibility as an excuse to show off more of Tom's body, pretty much.
Yeah, more of Tom's body. Heard a few swear words here and there. Only lightly peppered.
Yeah, it wasn't too gratuitous. It's good.
And I feel they told a much tighter story than the previous 3 seasons did.
I think I said last week that I felt that whereas it was a bit longer to 22-episode season, I felt it was a little shorter to 10-episode season. I could have stood another few episodes just in between, just to build a bit more plot building in between those major kind of arcs. Because it was like they took all the arc episodes and squashed them all together into 10 episodes, which is great. And I have no problem with doing that because you're taking out all the filler. But I could possibly have done just a couple more building episodes, maybe 12 in there, 12, 13, possibly. But it was a great series. It really was a good season. I thoroughly enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, it seems like it resolves.
Yeah.
There isn't much reason for it to come back for season 5. I would be surprised if it does.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope it does because I think it's great, but it does resolve fairly well.
And also, I just think sort of behind the scenes, it seems weird for me to see why they would come back for a season 5.
Right.
Given who owns what.
Yeah.
And where things are moving.
Yeah.
Just generally TV and streaming wise, it would seem a strange thing for them to go forward with another season after this.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, it definitely told a much tighter story, very focused. Unfortunately, a lot less tricksy. This is a crying shame. I would recommend it. Definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that sort of change, something changing network and it working so well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It does work as a shortened series. And I'm glad that they wrote it to get to a conclusion point. That way, if it doesn't come back, it had a satisfying ending. If it does come back, then yay. But if it doesn't come back, it has a reasonably satisfying conclusion, which is nice.
Yep. And the last sort of show I've been watching is Marvel's Cloak and Dagger.
Yes.
Which is back for its new season.
Yes.
Working its way through.
Haven't got back to that yet. Another one which is on my binging list.
Obviously, it's over here. It's on Amazon Prime. In the US, it's a Hulu show, and it's got very close ties with The Runaways. There's lots of rumors about them having a crossover. We'll have to see.
Okay, makes sense.
The show itself, it's a very interesting three will take. Not like any other Marvel show.
No.
Any other comic show on TV that I've seen in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Talks a lot about social issues. It has a very unique storytelling style. Not as crazy as Legion.
Yes.
It's still definitely non-linear.
Yeah. At least Cloak and Dagger is fairly coherent, where the season 2 of Legion was not at all.
Yes. So there should be a few more episodes left now. I would definitely recommend it. I hope it gets that renewal.
Yeah. There's a fair chance that'll get a renewal, I would have thought.
So. I feel like it's doing everything it can.
Yeah. As I say, not got back to the second season yet, but it is another one on my binging list. So I will go to it at some point. I've also been watching superhero stuff this week because, of course, Gotham came back. So I've been starting Gotham again.
The final season.
With the final season. It's a shortened run, isn't it? It's only 10 episodes or something, this final season.
I think it is.
Yeah. I like what they're doing on there because it's using the No Man's Land story, which was a great arc in the comic books, which I really enjoyed. I mean, they've changed it, obviously, dramatically because in the comic books, obviously, it's set when, you know, Bruce is Batman and they're introducing, you know, all the characters established and stuff. But they've used the basic elements of it, which is the fact that Gotham is split into zones now. So the police control one zone, but then Ivy has a zone and Penguin has an area. And, you know, so each of the gangs have sort of taken a particular part of Gotham and are controlling it because after the end of last season, when all the bridges were blown, they're basically stranded and on their own. So I really like what they're doing with that show. I love it. It's wonderfully bonkers. I'm glad that it's kind of a shorter run this time around and it should be a nice tight story and we'll get to a conclusion point. So I'm looking forward to watching the rest of this, but I'm really enjoying that show. That's really good. Also returned this week, New Amsterdam. That is back. That's the medical drama which stars Ryan Eggold from The Blacklist.
The Blacklist.
And he's great and so watchable. And it's a really solid medical drama, that. And it's on Amazon Prime over here, which is a bizarre place for it. I still don't quite understand how it ended up on Amazon Prime because I'm grateful it's somewhere, but it's very much a Sky Witness-y type show or Universal TV. It's a sort of procedural thing, but it's quite nicely structured in that a lot of the arcs do run across multiple episodes. It's not a sort of straight person comes in with problem, they fix problem, person leaves, everything resets. It's not that sort of straight procedural. There are a lot of overarching stories in it, with particularly the one to do with Ryan Eggle's character and the fact that he's got cancer and they're sort of dealing with that. So there's not much of a spoiler because it is revealed in the first episode. That I am really enjoying, and it's a solid medical drama. It's well worth going to watch. I also caught first episode of Mary Kills People, which is a Canadian drama which has won a whole bunch of different awards, and this is another one about a doctor, but in this particular case she's a doctor that has a day job working at a hospital but also moonlights as somebody that offers euthanasia services, obviously off the books because it's illegal in America, so offers euthanasia services to various people that are dying from terminal illnesses. It's a really interesting premise for a show, kind of intriguing to see how they approach it and whether she's going to get caught or stuff. I think it's only about 6 episodes this first season, so it's really quite short, but it's got 3 seasons already, I think. That's another one worth watching. So that's on More4 if you want to go and catch that, and you can find that on the catch up services as well. The other thing that I went to watch this week was Cobra Kai. I finally got around to using my YouTube Premium subscription, although in actual fact I think all those shows are coming off YouTube Premium.
You're
going to be able to watch them directly with ads. I finally got around to watching Cobra Kai. It's so much fun. As somebody who has a great fondness for the original Karate Kid movies, it's just great. I really enjoy it. I like the fact that you've got the two same actors, same leads that were in the original Karate Kid movie, and you're following the bad guy, essentially, from that first Karate Kid film, the one that he hits with the crane kick. And whereas the Karate Kid has gone off to be this car mogul and he's got like loads of different motor car franchises and stuff, the other guy is down on his luck. He's living in this crappy little apartment. He gets fired from his job, and it ends up with him setting up a new version of the Cobra Kai dojo, and ends up taking on a kid after the kid's being picked on, and he breaks up the fight and sort of takes down the bully. And then this kid comes to him and asks him for training. So it's essentially, it is basically the sort of plot of the Karate Kid, but with the you're following sort of the Cobra Kai guy mentoring this young kid rather than it being the other side. So it's funny. There's a lot of references. As somebody who's in his 40s and remembers the original when it went out, there's a lot of kind of references to 80s music and these damn kids are too young and that sort of stuff, which is hilarious. And I'm quite surprised how well they managed to do it. So I really enjoy watching that. Game of Thrones, of course, ended last night. We're not going to talk about Game of Thrones here, partly because Daryl hasn't seen it yet.
It did.
And partly because this is going to go out on Tuesday, so I don't want to spoil anything. What I will say is, if you want to find out more about Game of Thrones and our thoughts on that, go to the Reviewing Westeros podcast, which is over on entertainmenttalk.org. We'll be having the new episode of that go out on Wednesday, and that will be the sort of penultimate episode of the series, because we're going to do a wrap up one in a few weeks time as well. But yes, so that will give you our thoughts on the finale, so go and listen to that over on entertainmenttalk.org. And then we've got a few things coming up this weekend. It is, of course, MCM in London, and we have an interesting lineup of guests at MCM. Yep. Some of which we never thought would land at MCM, but due to some other issues from other cons in London, we've ended up with the whole of Team Arrow, or a large portion of Team Arrow. So Stephen Amell, David Ramsey, and Emily Bett Rickards are there, which was unexpected, and there was a lot of controversy over that, because. For those of you who don't know, there are two cons that were going on at the same time in London, and there's Heroes and Villains and there was MCM. And Heroes and Villains always pitch themselves directly up against MCM, and MCM basically have won that battle, because Heroes and Villains started to lose people for a variety of reasons. We don't know exactly officially why some people started to back out, but various guests started to back out of the Heroes and Villains Fan Fest, and there are a lot of rumours rumours about why that is happening, but we don't know whether any of that stuff is true. Stephen Amell was the first big one to go and basically backed out of Heroes and Villains and then immediately signed up for NCM pretty much afterwards. And then Heroes and Villains went down completely and they said they're going to move it and pair it up with Walker Stalker Con, which is another event that they did, which, you know, we've talked about on here before. They're going to pair the two of them together. So they're going to do them both at the same time. That basically freed up everybody who was a guest at Heroes and Villains to come and do MCM. So we've ended up with Stephen Amell, David Ramsey, Emily Rickards. The guy that plays Tyler Hoechlin as well, he plays Superman, he's going to be there.
So. Yes. I just note to say that Walker Stalker Con, which this year featured an absolute bucket load of the Walking Dead stars, takes place in February. You can head over to Hollywood News Source and type in Walker Stalker Con and you can see my coverage because I attended that.
Oh, cool. It had a bunch of Game of Thrones people there as well, I seem to remember. So.
It had Sam and the Night King, Bran, Hodor.
There was a whole bunch of them there. So that's really good. So along with the Team Arrow people at MCM, you've got Sebastian Stan, Winter Soldier. You've got David Harbour, who, of course, is the new Hellboy and also from Stranger Things. Misha Collins from Supernatural. Nolan North and Troy Baker, who is the video voiceover guys who are hilarious if you've never seen any of that stuff before. A bunch of people from Clerks, including Jason Mewes and Brian O'Hanlon. The Walking Dead Linz kids, you've got Madison, Maxon, and Matt. So that's Sophia and the two brothers that played Henry, the older and younger ones. There's a really good lineup this year. I'm very much looking forward to where we don't know who's going to be available for interview and who isn't. We'll have to wait and see. But that I'm very much looking forward to. That's MCM next week. I'm also doing the Good Omens premiere in London next week, so there's that as well, which means it's probably going to be an interview show from MCM next week. Then we're back live for a week, and then I'm on holiday for a few weeks. So there's going to be a few kind of interview shows over the next few weeks. So there's one normal show in between, a few interview shows. We'll be completely back to normal by the 25th of June. So that's sort of what we've got coming up for the next few weeks on Geek Tower Radio. Moving on, it was, of course, upfronts as well. So we did all the upfronts coverage last week. So we don't need to go through kind of all the renewals and cancellations. Go and listen to last week's show or go and check the website if you want to know that. But one of the things that came out over the actual upfronts presentations was they released a lot of the trailers. Was there any particular trailer which caught your eye or trailers which caught your eye?
Trailer that obviously carries the most interest for me would be Batwoman.
Yes.
Obviously, you see the new entry to the Arrowverse set on Earth One, for those people who really know Arrowverse stuff, featuring Kate Kane, who is Batwoman in the comics, returning to Gotham.
Yes.
In the wake of the disappearance of the Bat for a number of years and seeing the state of the city, decides to take matters into her own hands after discovering her cousin's nifty toys.
Yes.
And comes into conflict with, I think it's the big bad being Rachel Skarsten, who you might know from Rain on CW or Lost Girl.
Right, yeah. Seasons. It's the Wonderland gang. They've appropriated the Wonderland gang because they're usually attached to a different villain. It's appropriate because the villain's Alice, who is a sort of psychotic version of Alice in Wonderland. And it's usually attached to the Mad Hatter, the Wonderland gang, but they've kind of appropriated it and attached it to Alice for the TV show. There's also the Crows as well. Crows Private Security, which is run by Jacob Kane, played by DeGray Scott, who is the father of Kate Kane. And they're supposedly the people that are supposed to be protecting Gotham but aren't doing a very good job of it by the sound of it, which is why Kate decides to take over or take matters into her own hands. So I'm very much looking forward to this. I think the trailer looks really good. Looks like it's going to be a solid show. I think I said last week this seems to be a great stand-in for Arrow. I think this is going to be a good replacement for it. Interestingly, they did announce how they were going to run them. They've paired
two nights, which is an interesting decision.
Yeah.
So that would be Batwoman and Supergirl.
Yeah.
on Sundays, and I believe the Flash and thing on Tuesdays.
Yes, Flash and Arrow on Tuesdays until Arrow ends, and then presumably that's going to get replaced by Legends, because Legends has been delayed to mid-season, so that's sort of January-ish.
To take over. Huh?
That's the US side dates, of course. In the UK, I rather suspect they'll end up running every night. They'll probably run out four nights a week, and they'll just carry on doing that. And they will start sometime in the autumn, then we'll break at Christmas, and we'll probably get them back February, March, they've done previously. So, I mean, it will run pretty much as it has done for every year up until, over here. That is assuming that Sky One have picked up Batwoman, which, I mean, I can't imagine they won't.
Yeah.
But at the moment, they haven't officially said, yes, they've taken it. So,
Silly not to.
Yeah, but I can't imagine they won't be taking it. I mean, unless they lose out for whatever reason, but I can't imagine that they won't. So, anything else from the trailers?
The other trailer for me that really caught my eye was Emergence, which is on ABC, which is this very strange show about a sheriff who goes to report an object that crashed into the beach and finds a little girl, decides to take her in, only for strange happenstances to start occurring, and strange shadowy organization suddenly comes to try and get the girl back.
Yeah.
The trailer instantly sucked me in. And then as I was watching and thinking, this looks really interesting, in the back of my mind, I got that little niggle. This is going to be cancelled after one season.
Yes.
They're going to suck us in. They're going to drop some crazy finale, and then it's going to get cancelled.
Yeah, it has got cancelled after one season, written all over it, but it does look really good.
Because it reminds me of that show that went to Amazon Prime.
Yes.
The Crossing.
Yeah, The Crossing. No,
It was almost exactly like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely the same thing to me. I mean, it's got a great cast. It's got some interesting people behind it. It's Michelle Fazakas and Tara Butters, who did Reaper, was one of the shows they did. They did Kevin Probably Saves the World as well, but Reaper, but that never aired out here, Reaper did. The pilot, directed by Paul McGuigan, who is one of Gatiss and Moffat's guys, so he's done Sherlock. Okay. He's doing this Dracula thing that they're doing as well. It's a really good director behind it. Alison Tolman, who's in Good Girls and Fargo as the lead. I really like this. Oh, and it's got Donald Faison in it from Scrubs in a serious dramatic role rather than
Do you not think that the little girl looks exactly like the sheriff?
To be honest, I hadn't really spotted that, but
go back and watch it.
I didn't notice that at the time.
They do look scarily similar. Those are my sort of the interest ones, one of which is not going to be cancelled, and the other one Probably is.
Yeah, I entirely agree with you. It's got one season written all over it, that Emergence. But I would like to see more of it. I mean, in terms of the trailers that came out, I thought Evil looked interesting, which is supernaturally kind of show. Interesting one for CBS, of all places. But thought that kind of looked interesting. Basically, sort of misfit group of people thrown together. One's a skeptic, one's a priest, and there's another guy in there as well. Kind of X-Files-y, but with a more supernatural bent rather than a straight up sort of thing. Comes from the creators of The Good Wife. It's got Mike Colter in it from Luke Cage. It's got Michael Emerson in it from Lost and Person of Interest. It's got Katia Herbers in it from Westworld. As is Mandy from Blue Bloods.
Oh, that's where she's from. I literally stared at her for the whole thing, going, I've seen you from something. And now it makes sense why I wouldn't realize who it was.
Yes. Yeah. There's a new Westworld trailer out as well this morning.
Is there?
Yes, which looks really good. Asif Mandiv as well, from a series of Unfortunate Events and Daily Show. He was a correspondent of for a while as well. But it's kind of religion, supernatural stuff, kind of all mixed up together. That's Evil, though, which looked really, really intriguing. I thought that was quite good. Prodigal Son is the other one, which we talked about quite a bit last week. It's another Berlanti show. It's exec produced by Greg Berlanti, the Arrowverse guy. It's written by Chris Fadak, who wrote Deception and Chuck, and Sam Sclaver, who wrote Deception and Bored to Death.
Wait, Deception is in the One and Done show?
Yes, I believe so, yes.
Okay.
It stars Tom Payne. It also stars Michael Sheen. Tom Payne from The Walking Dead played Jesus. Michael Sheen, who been in everything. Essentially, a serial killer drama about, it's kind of got a Hannibal Lectery sort of thing going on.
Yeah.
It's
a troubled profiler.
Yeah. Tom Payne plays Michael Bright, who's the troubled profiler. His father was a serial killer called The Surgeon, and that's the character that Michael Sheen plays. There are some copycat killings that's going on, so the estranged son goes to his father and like, can you help me with this, because there appears to be somebody copying your style. And it's not entirely clear why, you know, whether he has any knowledge of this or whether he could help or what his motivations are. Yeah, so it looks interesting and different.
It does
It looks like quite a good show, that, so I'm quite intrigued by that one. But there's a trailer up for that. There are a few of those as well, but I think we'll leave it there. It's an interesting selection. All the trailers, if you want to go and watch the trailers, they are all up on the website, including a bunch that we haven't mentioned, for shows that we haven't mentioned. There's a lot of comedies and other things in there as well, but those are the ones that I think stood out particularly to us, I would say. If you want to go and see the rest, go to geektown.co.uk. We've got all the trailers up on there and all those clips and stuff. That's the stuff we've been doing this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news. So we kick off the TV and film news with renewals, cancellations and pickups. And there are quite a lot, considering we did a whole bunch last week, there are quite a lot more this week. Empire, which we announced was renewed last week, they've also now announced is going to end with its sixth season, which, yeah, it's fine. You know, I kind of dropped out of Empire after a couple of seasons. So, you know, whatever. Madam Secretary, they've also said that it's going to end on its sixth season as well. There's a lot of people petitioning for them to be a Madam President series after that, and sort of to continue it on, but Madam Secretary is going to end with season six. Power, the 50 Cent series, that is also ending on a sixth season, but they're kind of hinting that although that is ending, they're just ending that story, and there is almost certainly going to be a spin-off coming as well, which is following other characters or some of the characters from the show in different directions. So there's that. The Tick has been cancelled after two seasons, although the creator is saying he's looking for a new home for it, but that was cancelled by Amazon. I mean, I'm amazed it actually got picked up anywhere in the first place, because it's I think that's very much dead.
It's been swatted.
Yes. Which is a shame, because it is a wonderfully stupid series. I really love it, but
is it any better than a cartoon?
Well, no, possibly not, but I mean, you know, I think it's a shame, but yeah, I can't see managing to sell that anywhere else. On UK TV, Channel 4 have renewed Friday Night Dinner for a sixth season. Freeform in America have renewed Siren for a third season and The Bold Type for a fourth season. Sci-fi series Snowpiercer, which I can't remember which network that's on. Is it TNT that are airing that? No, it's TBS that are airing that, weirdly. They're starting to push drama out on TBS, which has basically been comedy up until now. They're starting to push drama out, so because it was ordered by TNT and they bumped it over to TBS. But Snowpiercer, which is based on the film and the book, that's been renewed for a second season before season one even airs. And season one's not arriving until spring 2020, but it's already been picked up internationally by Netflix.
That does make sense.
Yes. So that's renewed for two seasons now, which is good. Over on Amazon, they've picked up the international rights to the Star Trek Picard series. Is really upsetting Netflix, I imagine, in doing so, because Netflix have all the other Star Treks. So, yeah.
Did they?
Yeah. They have.
I didn't know they had all the other ones. I knew they obviously they had the Discovery thing, but I didn't see that was because it was new. CBS All Access probably just wanted the money. So they've got like Enterprise and TOS and.
Yeah, they have everything. On Netflix UK has everything. Yeah. I think it's slightly different in other places. Like, I think Amazon in the US have all the Star Treks as well.
Surely they don't, because CBS All Access has them. And there'd be no point doubling them up.
Maybe. Well, apparently they're sort of all over the place. I don't know. But yes, in the UK, Star Trek Picard will be going out on Amazon, which has upset a lot of UK fans, because they're like, oh, I don't want to have to get Amazon and Netflix. And it's like, well, you know, that's who they sold it to. So that's what you're going to have to deal with.
It's £8.
People. Yeah. You know, and you can turn it on and off on a monthly basis. So, you know, turn it on for a month, turn it off again.
And exactly. Turn it off, watch it. And that's the end of that.
Yeah. And Amazon's got some amazing stuff coming up over the next few years. So,
and it's got a lot of like 5-year-old shows that are more than worth watching if you haven't seen them.
Yes,
the only problem for me is that I literally look through these and think, oh, yeah, I've seen all these.
Yeah.
So there's no point in watching them again.
But he's got some great stuff on there, so you know it's worth getting. Black Mirror season 5. Well, they say season 5. It's 3 episodes, so it's not a long season, but it is season 5 coming to Netflix on the 5th of June. They've announced, and there is a little trailer which gives basically nothing away, but there is a little trailer up for that. So that looks really good. And they've announced that Disenchantment, the Matt Groening series, that is returning in September to Netflix for the second half of season 1.
Oh.
And it is already renewed for a second season, that as well. Okay. The only other thing was, as we mentioned earlier, the CW in the US have paired up Batwoman, Supergirl, Flash, Arrow, Legends Hell to Mid-Season. They've also said that the crossover event is going to go over the mid-season break. So there's going to be...
released a lot of information quite early.
Yeah.
So this is a lot earlier than they did last year.
Yeah. So Crisis in Infinite Earths, which, you know, we know that's the crossover event. We know that it's going to probably be quite game-changing with what they're doing with the Arrowverse. You've got 3 episodes before the season break and then 2 episodes the, afterwards.
Winter break. Yeah.
And then 2 episodes afterwards. Well. So it looks like the Arrow will come back, run up to the break, and then that will be the end of Arrow, and then Legends will probably take that slot coming back. As I say,
and they've also confirmed that Legends are back in.
Yes,
after taking the break last year,
and it will involve all 5 shows. So it will involve
5 hours of
It will be a 5 hours worth of crossover this time around, which is awesome. So I mean, I've given every time we've spoken to them, all the actors and any of the production team have always said, yeah, they're a nightmare to do those. So I'm surprised.
But I think obviously with the placement of it makes it a lot easier, because before they'd be quite early. This probably gives them a little bit more time.
Yeah, maybe that's the case.
Given that, and given that obviously Arrow, there's a lot less filming going on there.
Yeah. So maybe that's why. But yeah, that's awesome. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they bring with that crossover
very
event.
Much so,
Whether it does completely alter the Arrowverse entirely, that's going to be interesting to see.
I wonder if they're going to collapse it and make it one world.
Yes, that was because that is what it does in the comic books. So I do wonder if that is going to be the case.
And I wonder if that one world will include Black Lightning.
Yeah, you see, they haven't mentioned Black Lightning as part of this, but...
And they don't have to. Mean that they can't collapse them all into one place.
Yeah, so I do wonder whether that might happen, whether you might get a surprise appearance, or I don't know. That would be quite cool if that does happen. But
I would think a 60% chance of Earth-S and Earth-1 getting combined.
I think that's quite likely. Yeah. So that's all good. Sticking with DC, though, there was another big DC announcement.
It was so big it actually beat my phone, and I don't know how my phone decides what to beat me for, because I probably get beat for maybe once or twice a week. And it beat me with these two actors are in the line to play Batman, and then by the time I clicked on it, everywhere else is running that it was only one person.
Yes, Matt Reeves, the director, has taken over the Batman movie franchise, which we've talked about previously. Now it looks like he might have found his Dark Knight, and it looks like it could be Robert Pattinson. I don't know. It's an interesting choice. He's certainly got the jawline for it. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I think it's only probably weird because people are still remembering when it was Ben Affleck. And obviously that's a bit of a change.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is a bit of a change.
And she just got him younger by 20 years. So.
Yeah, but we knew they were going to go younger. I mean, they talked about going younger because
I haven't been paying attention.
They've talked about it going younger, mainly because I think he wants to set this much earlier on in sort of Bruce's Batman career. I don't think they're going to do an origin story. I don't think it's going to be that, but I think it's going to be sort of almost year one, maybe, of Bruce being Batman. So it's going to be much earlier on. That seemed to be where they were heading with it. So we always knew that it was going to be a younger actor, or it was very likely going to be a younger actor. And having said that, actually, Robert Pattinson, although he's most remembered for the Twilight movies, isn't actually... Well,
I think my son would remember Harry Potter.
Well, yes, there is that as well, of course. He actually... is not the youngest person to take the role, because
that's quite weird.
Apparently Christian Bale was 31 when he took the role, and although Arbat does look younger, I would argue he's actually a couple of years older than when Christian Bale took the role, apparently. So
I think probably because we forget that Christian Bale was a child actor. So he's been around for so long, we assume he's a lot older than he actually is.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, we didn't really complain it when that happened. So I think fine.
I don't have a problem with that. I think it'd be fine. I think if you actually take the time to look into Patterson's back catalogue post-Twilight, you see that he's done a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's definitely no reason for him not. And at the end of the day, this is Batman. This is not Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they're talking about it being a much more of a detective story as well as him. Oh. You know,
it's like a film noir.
Yeah, it's supposed to be much more of a sort of film noir, much closer to the kind of darker comic book stuff.
And, I think that's interesting. And I think that makes me more interested.
Yeah, I rather than just be big, flashy, like dumb, stupid, you know, it's not going to be that. And given the stuff that Patterson has done since Twilight, I mean, he did Twilight, made a shed load of money, probably didn't ever need to work again after doing those films. And
which is probably why he chose all the weird stuff.
Yeah, and he's
lots of independent, lots of things.
Yeah, independent art house movies. He's done a lot.
Christian Stewart did. Her film career.
Yeah, so he's done a lot of quite highly respected, you know, stuff that's like launched at Cannes Film Festival and that sort of thing. So his career after Twilight is a lot of kind of art house and indie movies and that sort of thing. And I think that very much seems to be by choice, you know, rather than doing these big things. So I'm quite excited for this. I mean, the thing is, there was a lot of backlash when this was announced, and there always is. I mean, you can dig up newspaper reports of when they announced Michael Keaton as Batman for those original Tim Burton movies, and the amount of backlash then when he was announced was fairly high, and so people said the same when Ben Affleck was announced. So, you know, I have no problem. I think it'd be interesting what we actually end up calling him is I mean, whether it's Patman or Bat-Pat. I don't know. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think it could be really interesting. Moving on to Netflix, but sticking with comic books, they've commissioned a new show called The Magic Order, which is based on the Mark Miller comic book. If you remember last year or the year before, Netflix bought Millerworld, which is Mark Miller's comic book studio. So Netflix owned the comic book studio. Then the first comic that they released as a comic book was The Magic Order, written by Miller. That went out as a comic book. They've now turned that comic book into a TV series, which was probably the plan all along, I suspect. Mm. But they're using the comic books to basically test the water to see what might work as a TV series for the looks of things. Magic Order, Miller describes it as The Sopranos meets Harry Potter, which I think is a great, great description of it.
That sounds like a man who sold something in Hollywood before.
Yeah, absolutely. Story follows five families of magicians sworn to protect our world for generations who must battle an enemy that is picking them off one by one. By day, they live amongst us as neighbours, friends and co-workers, but by night they are sorcerers, magicians and wizards that protect us from the forces of darkness, unless the darkness gets them first. So I think that looks really quite interesting. It's exec produced by James Wan from Aquaman, director of Aquaman, and Lindsay Beer, who did some shows called Chaos Walking, and Sierra Burgess is a Loser, which was a Netflix movie she did. She's been the writer on it, and he's going to be the showrunner. James Wan's going to direct the premiere episode. It's exec produced by a bunch of people from James Wan Production Company, so guys behind, I think they did some MacGyver and Swamp Thing, the DC Swamp Thing series. Mm-hmm. So they kind of, yeah, they're involved with the DC stuff already, obviously. Mm-hmm. So they know the comic book things. I think this sounds kind of interesting. I mean,
that sounds quite interesting,
no,
I think.
Casting yet, but I rather like the description. I like Miller's work. So the comic book was first released June 2018. They bought Millerworld back in 2017. Then June 2018, this was the first comic book that was released under the Netflix Millerworld flag. Didn't finish its run until February 2019, and then they've now commissioned it as a TV show. And we've also got other TV shows based on Miller's comic books coming, like Jupiter's Legacy's got, that's quite way into production actually, that, because there's a bunch of casting out for that. American Jesus is in production as a series. They're doing film adaptations of Empress, Hook, Sharky the Bounty Hunter. So there's a whole load of, I mean, they're using the Miller back catalogue quite extensively. Netflix hasn't given a release date for The Magic Order season one yet. I wouldn't expect it before 2020, at least, given that it's obviously going to have effects and stuff in it.
Yeah, and even if it was to start production today, it would seem to be,
it's going to be probably late 2020 at the earliest, because they haven't even announced casting yet for it. So, Lindsay Beer, by the way, interesting. She's Sierra Burgess is a Loser is kind of probably the biggest thing on her list at the moment, but she's gone on. She's writing the Empress movie, which is based on Mark Miller's stuff. She's also writing a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles reboot and a
film.
A new reboot of Short Circuit, apparently the classic 80s film.
That's controversial.
Yes,
I mean, if you think people have strong opinions about Ghostbusters, so if you want to miss me, Short Circuit is an amazing film.
We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But apparently, that's the other thing she's working on. Somebody likes her out there in Hollywood. But that's The Magic Order coming to Netflix. That's all the news for this week. Let's move on to an interview.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The interview this week is with Miles Hankin, who is the composer of Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron's Longshot, which stars Rogen and Theron in a romantic comedy. And Theron plays the Secretary of State, who is now running for president. And she bumps into a guy who I think she used to babysit him. I think that's the basic setup of it. And he is a sort of out of work screenwriter, and she hires him as a speechwriter, and hilarity ensues. That's basically the sort of setup for the film. Miles has been composing the music for that. He's got a bunch of other things under his belt as well. He's worked quite a lot with Marco Beltram, which means that he worked on A Quiet Place, which of course was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Score. He worked on the music for Marvel's fantastic, much maligned Fantastic Four movie, The Shadows, Universal's The Snowman. He's done a bunch of other things like HBO documentaries and various other bits and pieces as well. So we talk about all that sort of stuff, and particularly Longshot, because that's the thing that's obviously been out most recently. Here's the interview with Miles. We will see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. It's lovely to have you come on and chat for a little bit. We're mainly talking about Longshot, which is the romantic comedy you've been doing recently. But before we get into that, let's do a little bit of background. How did you get into composing in the first place?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I can honestly say film composer was the first job I ever wanted when I was a kid.
Wow.
Pretty single-minded about it. It's funny. Most kids want to be an astronaut or a doctor. I wanted to be a film composer, and I think it came from a trip to New York City when I was about 8 years old. My father took us to see a 70mm print screening of Lawrence of Arabia, and I was so mesmerized by everything, the visual spectacle and the amazing score by Maurice Jarre. And I remember asking my father, how does this work? How does this amazing music get, embedded into the movie? And he said, well, there's a composer and they write the score and then they record it and blah, blah, blah. And the whole thing was so mystifying and kind of magical to me. And I was always sort of fantasized about the idea of writing music that could be accompanied by such amazing visual, storytelling. And so, years later, when I began to really focus on music, around the age of 10, I was studying piano and composition and violin and music theory and all these things. And I ended up going to school for music. I have a Bachelor of Music from the University of Miami School of Music. I've studied at the Eastman School of Music and also in New York with a composer called Darren Hagen, who is a very prolific American composer of opera music and art music. And, you know, he's a real sort of legitimate classical composer. You know, he studied with Leonard Bernstein and at Juilliard and wow. everything. And
yeah.
so I kind of had this pretty traditional upbringing musically. But of course, at the same time, I was more of a jazz piano player. I was playing in a lot of rock bands, and I was also experimenting with electronic music production all like every step of the way. So I always had one foot in more of kind of commercial music. And really the whole thing was ultimately kind of shaping towards film scoring. But I was in New York City. This was 2004. I had just finished my undergrad. I had just kicked around the Caribbean for 6 months as a musical director for Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. That was a fun summer job, you know, when you're 21 years old. That was a lot of fun. And then, you know, moved up to New York City, which is actually where I'm originally from. So basically moved back there and learned very quickly that it's difficult, very difficult to make a living playing jazz piano in the big city as one of the most expensive places on earth to live. That just wasn't cutting it. So I ended up, you know, taking a day job and sort of paying the bills. And around that time, I submitted for a competition that was judged by Hans Zimmer, and that was the Turner Classic Movies Young Film Composers Competition. And I submitted for that, was selected as one of the five finalists. And then, they flew me out to Los Angeles. I got to meet with Hans Zimmer. I got to sort of hang around the city a bit and plug into the culture out here. And, you know, actually got a few job offers in my first visit. So within a year, I actually moved out here. And this was the summer of 2007. And I decided to make the move and began working on a little TV series called Flash Gordon for the Sci-Fi Network.
Yeah.
And That was the beginning of it all, and the rest is sort of history. I've been out here now for about 12 years. I've been working constantly, consistently ever since, and it's been a great adventure. But yeah, that's sort of the long version of the story. But that's it.
That's awesome, though. So the film you've been working on most recently is Long Shot, which is kind of a bit of a homecoming or coming back together for you, because it's Jonathan Levine and Marco Beltram, who you've worked with before. I mean, you've worked that's with Marco right. numerous times, but you've done other films with them as well, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. We had scored a film for Jonathan called The Night Before. That was a holiday comedy, and we had a lot of fun with that. That one also starred Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and that was a great kind of ensemble comedy cast. We had a lot of fun with that one. Of course, that score was much more of kind of a traditional holiday score. There was a bit of a nod to sort of Home Alone sound, you know, a bit of that Nutcracker Tchaikovsky sound to it, which was a lot of fun to do. This is a more, well, we'll get into the music, but yes, it was sort of like getting the band back together. You know, working with Jonathan is always so great. He's a really cool guy. He cares very, very deeply about the music. He focuses a lot on the songs that he places in his films, and then the score kind of takes more of a storytelling role and kind of fills in the gaps. But he cares very, very passionately about it, and he was he's an interesting guy because he likes to let you kind of experiment and explore ideas. And so when Marco and I were, you know, kicking around themes and ideas, he would just sort of give us these little, you know, positive encouraging texts and emails, you know, words of encouragement, and then we would sort of present him with the themes, and fortunately, you know, he liked the music very much that we were coming up with from the beginning, and so he sort of let us just kind of run with it. But yeah, he likes to give his composers creative space, which I think is very important, because many directors don't really know how to do that, and so I think it's a bit daunting or a bit scary, I think, for some filmmakers to sort of let their baby go into the hands of a composer for a while and just cross their fingers. So Jonathan is he's willing to do that, and I think that always benefits the creative process. But anyway, yeah, it was great working with these guys again, and it's always thrilling to work on something that you know, it's just a fun movie, and it's just something that people liked. We were at the South by Southwest premiere, and the audience was like just literally rolling in the aisles. So it was. It's a lot of fun. And then Boyz II Men came out and sang two songs, you know, after the movie ended, and turned the whole theater into a big dance party, you know.
Oh, wow.
So that was That was pretty great.
That's awesome. You're writing for Longshot is a romantic comedy. You're writing music for a romantic comedy. I assume that the purpose is not to try and kind of go in with a funny soundtrack for the film.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of the trick, I think, with comedy is to not try to make the music funny. I don't even know if it's possible to do that. But I think that if you can sort of play it sincerely, especially the personal story, if you can try to play the romance and just give it its credit, you know, there's a sort of an absurd premise to the film, of course, you know, but the idea that these two might actually find something in one another that that really ignites a spark, it's a charming notion, and I think that the actors pull it off, and I think the music really, the role of the music there was to not get in the way of that and not screw it up, basically, because you know it's such a nice thing when the acting is good and the writing is funny and so that's all working, and so the music isn't required to serve a sort of helping hand function in that regard. It's almost the job is almost to more stay out of the way and just create a little halo of magic around it, and that's what we tried to do. And then of course there's other scenes where there's just broad physical comedy happening. Yeah. You know, like when Seth Rogen literally just falls down like three flights of stairs at warp speed and crashes on the floor. You know, there's really not much you can do there except just laugh. And that in those more broad action moments, you know, we kind of took it to the next level and let the music play a bit more full, a bit more kind of winking with the audience, that kind of thing. But when the story takes, you know, the serious turns, we definitely tried to treat it as if it were just really a dramatic film. And I think our instrumentational choices, you know, we had things like ukuleles and unusual hand percussion, and there were certain quirky elements just to the instruments in the score that alone sort of gave it a bit of color and character. We didn't need to sort of Mickey Mouse anything and try to, in terms of the writing, we didn't really need to make it too silly or too funny.
Yeah. How do you divide stuff up? Because you're working with Marco on this, and you know, presumably you've worked together a number of times now, so you've got a good shorthand of like how you work around problems and how you divide up the workload. Is it a case of one person comes up with a theme and then you expand on that, or do you just split it down the middle? How does the process work?
Yeah, you know, it's different with every film, but you're absolutely right. Marco and I have collaborated on a number of projects over the last 5 or so years, and it's always really rewarding to work with him. Marco's one of my favorite composers in Hollywood. He's I think one of the most original voices in the sort of film music landscape, and he's also just a really good guy. He's very generous in terms of the opportunities that he affords me and some of the other folks that we work with. And not all the composers out there are like that. You know, Marco has a very small team. You know, it's really just a few people, and he trusts us a lot. So there's a lot of this mutual trust and respect that kind of goes into that. And that's what allows us to kind of do what we do together, I think. In terms of our process, you know, I have my own studio here in Burbank, and Marco has his own beautiful studio in Malibu. And so we don't work in the same space. We keep our own kind of creative spaces and our own processes. Working with Marco is very much like really any project that I score on my own. I come to work in the morning, I set up my rig, I have my own team of people here, my own assistants, and I just write music. But when I'm collaborating with Marco, it's very much a question of sharing ideas with one another. Sometimes Marco will start writing ideas first, and come up with thematic material like you mentioned before. And sometimes theme ideas might actually come from me or someone else in our team, and we'll sort of pass them around and experiment with them and see what works the best. But Marco is always sort of the all-seeing eye that kind of manages everything, and he's really, it's extraordinary to see him under pressure because he's so calm. He maintains like a really even temper and a really kind of focused overview of everything, especially when he's juggling multiple large projects at once. It's pretty impressive. So he's definitely the guy you want at the helm when a project gets kind of crazy, or if the pressures are really turned up to 11. You know, it's really cool to watch him in action, because he sort of sets the pace and reminds us how he can sort of elegantly navigate through those waters. And when the rest of us are sort of like, you know, inclined to scream and jump off the ship, you know, he's there steering us to safe harbor. But yeah, no, it's cool. And like I said, every project's different. I mean, last year we did A Quiet Place. That was a film score that was, you know, there was a lot of different sort of artistic considerations, sort of just in terms of, you know, what should the music do in a film with no dialogue? You know, how big should it go? How much should we pull it back? And there was a lot of experimentation with that score. We did a lot of trial and error, kind of spent a lot of hours in the lab, so to speak, you know, experimenting with sound design and building instruments from the ground up. And we even at one point brought in a huge orchestra to record all kinds of weird aleatoric gestures that we thought we might be able to sort of manipulate. And you know, we just tried everything. We just threw like as much paint on the canvas as we could until finally something started to take shape. But that was a sort of an unusually difficult puzzle to solve. A film like Long Shot, it really kind of came down to understanding just the three kind of main areas of the movie. There's this beautiful kind of intimate personal story that we decided to score with simple themes played on, you know, acoustic guitars, ukuleles, mandolins, and that kind of thing. Then there was this sort of sense of sweeping patriotism and kind of broad orchestral work, you know, music that could really lay into that Americana side of the story, which was a lot of fun to write that. And we had a big 60-piece orchestra for that. And then we had these, you know, we had these like kind of funny action scenes that were really just over the top. And we kind of went full tilt with that and gave it more of like a hybrid electronic orchestral thing and really went kind of intense with it, because it just seemed to push the comedy of it. And so those were the three kind of main sounds of the score. And actually the score was just released today, which is pretty exciting. It's on, you know, Spotify and Apple Music and iTunes and all that fun stuff. So it's nice to see that get out there. And, you know, just listening back to it, it's a lovely little score, and it's got lots of kind of nice twists and turns in it. And it's interesting to just scroll through the tracks and hear how, you know, here's one track that has a kind of a funky, you know, sort of 8-bit Nintendo guitar effect happening and electric bass. And then the next score is this sort of Gershwin-esque 1940s reorchestration of our theme that plays in one of these great gala dinner scenes, you know, in Buenos Aires. Is a very elegant scene. That was a lot of fun to do that. And then the next cue is some sort of almost Copeland-esque kind of Americana soaring, sweeping theme. So, you know, it's funny to kind of, now that I've had about a year of distance from the score, it's kind of fun to listen back to it and hear all the little diversions and all the little circuitous journeys that it takes along the way. It's pretty cool.
That's very cool. Nice to get such a mix into one film as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
You mentioned using things like ukuleles and mandolins there. What's the strangest thing you've ever sort of picked up to get a sound out of for a score?
I don't think I'm allowed to say that. No, I don't know. You know, it's funny. I mean, it really is amazing the things that we will try to utilize just to create some sort of a sonic effect. I mean, it almost becomes more like in the world of Foley, or in the world of like what Ben Burtt would do to create, you know, the sound of the lightsaber, or you know, all these kind of iconic things. I mean, we did a movie called The Shallows a couple of years ago, which was sort of this really intense shark film, basically. It was right. Starring Blake Lively. And, you know, we experimented with a lot of things for a sound for the shark that could be sort of musical, but still sort of convey some kind of prehistoric, I don't know, primal sort of monster sound, but underwater, and, you know, it still be musical. So it's not just a sound effect. And we ended up using, we hung these huge metal plates, like reverb plates, basically, from the ceiling. And then we would bow them with all kinds of, like, you know, double bass bows, and it would create this like this kind of roar, but wow. It had this muted, muffled quality to it that almost made it sound like it was underwater. And then it also had a pitch, and it had like, you could sort of manipulate the pitch a little bit. And so it had this sense of really struggling to kind of change pitch. And there was a sense of intensity and urgency within the sound. And I don't know, it was just crazy, but it kind of worked. And then we sort of wove that into the actual score cues and things like that. But I mean, I could give you a million examples. I mean, Marco and his creative collaborator, Buck Sanders, they've been doing this kind of crazy stuff for years and years and years. And I think the first day I met Buck, he was outside up on the cliffside in Malibu next to their studio. And he had been stringing these piano wires across the cliffside, and he had attached them to literally an upright piano on one side and then a water tank on the other side, stretched maybe 50 yards apart. And he called it, it was an Aeolian piano, in the sense that these piano wires would actually sympathetically resonate when the wind blew, and it would create these humming tunes. And then if you put the microphone near the soundboard of the piano, that would in turn trigger some other pitch sympathetic vibrations. And it was just insane. I mean, that level of sound design, that alone could take the whole 3 months, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, the idea of getting any writing done when you're having that much fun, it just seems impossible to me. But it's pretty cool. And I think a lot more now in scores you'll hear this. There's more of an emphasis on not just what the notes are, but the what's the actual sound that's performing the notes, and putting a lot more emphasis on production, sound design, sometimes at the expense of composition. But I think it's an interesting time to just explore and experiment, and it's cool to hear different stuff, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you've worked on a few kind of sci-fi projects as well and stuff. I mean, you worked a bit on the Fantastic Four movie. Mm-hmm. I should say the much maligned Fantastic Four movie, but I rather enjoyed it.
Very much maligned and you know, probably
underrated. I think is probably
rightly so. Well, I think the film, you know, there were a lot of issues, I think, in terms of the production of that film.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
Those issues have been enumerated ad nauseum online. But I think, you know, in terms of the score, that was actually a very, well, it was a tricky process. There was a lot of pressure, I remember now, and it was, but I was very happy with the end result of the score. And I did end up writing quite a lot of that score. And it's a score that I'm particularly proud of, because that was my first film collaboration with Marco. And you know, I came in late on that. I think I had met Buck, but I hadn't really worked with them yet. And it was just an opportunity to come in. I think things had gotten pretty crazy there. It was just a high pressure situation. And I came in, and it was sort of a trial by fire for me. I was sort of thrown right into the deep end on that. And so I'll always have a kind of a positive association with it. But it's a good lesson to learn that, you know, when you work so hard on something, you know, you put your heart and soul into it, and then to see the film do poorly, you know, that's a very important lesson for all film composers and really everyone in the business to kind of learn.
Yeah.
Where, you know, no one sets out to make a quote bad film. You know, everyone works really hard, and I'm sure anybody who worked on that film would agree that they worked just as hard on that film as they did on other things they may have done that were successful. Yeah. It's just, you know, at a certain point, it either works or it doesn't. It goes out to the world, and then it's up to the audience to decide. And
yeah,
certainly, I mean, Marvel fans are some of the most discerning, if stringent, critics and fans. So those are the ones you really got to work hard to please. But I think
the thing with that movie was, I don't think it actually was a bad film. I just think it was a film that wasn't anything what people expected it would be. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. You know, yeah. I think it was more that, and it was like, this isn't Fantastic Four. It was something else entirely. And as you say, Marvel fans can be vicious when they want to be. So.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree. I just think structurally, I don't know. It almost seemed like they just ran out of time.
Yeah.
And the whole third act just doesn't quite work, you know. But again, you know, from the point of view of the score, you know, what we ended up with was something that I'll always be proud of. I think it's a great score. I think it's a great kind of adventure, sci-fi adventure comic book score. And, you know, it's just interesting to see how that whole world has evolved since then. Of course, now, you know, Disney pretty much owns everything. And so now the Marvel Universe can sort of flex its unencumbered muscles and do literally anything it wants to do. And it sounds like they're really getting it right now, you know, with Endgame, all this stuff. So it's cool to see that crazy journey that it's taken across all these different property owners, and now to finally see it all consolidated and the fans are happy. It's been a wild ride. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
I mean, it yes, It looks like Fantastic. Well, hopefully Fantastic Four will come back again in some form. Now it's part of the Marvel Universe.
Right, that's right.
Scrolling back down through your IMDb, which is something I tend to do. I go and look people up when I'm interviewing them on IMDb and scroll to the bottom because that's always really interesting. First few movies that are on the bottom of your composing credits. I love B-films. And there's a set of fabulous B-film names like Chrome Angels, Wolfsbane, spelt with a Y, important that, House of Bones, Quantum Apocalypse, and Monster Wolf, which is, these were sci-fi movies, weren't they? They were for the Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, yes.
And I have a huge affection for B-movies, and these sound wonderful. I rather suspect that, is the process a case of, here's no money, go and make me a soundtrack?
Yeah, you know, that was, I think, my first or second year in LA, and I had just moved out. I was working with a composer called John Dixon, who's a brilliant composer. He was scoring the series Burn Notice, which was a very successful
hit show. Fabulous.
And John is one of my, you know, oldest buddies in LA, and someone I respect immensely. And when I first came out to LA, I was assisting him on a number of projects, and he had had in the past he had done a few of those films, and he knew that I was sort of trying to make some extra bucks, and he didn't really need to be working on those anymore. So he sort of threw some of those my way, and I ended up doing about four or five of those early on. And, you know, it was an amazing learning experience, I have to say, because it's really like you say, I mean, there's not a lot of money, so you're not going to have a lot of opportunity to record anything live, but they all want these huge scores, you know, it's like a 90 minute action sci-fi film, and it needs, you know, 88 minutes of bombastic orchestral score, you know, and they need it in like 3 weeks, you know, it's full insanity. So I would get those gigs, and I would just stay up for 3 weeks. I would just pour, like, you know, vats of coffee, and I would stay up for 3 weeks straight scoring them. And it's amazing what you sort of learn about yourself in those processes, because there's no like opportunity for second guessing. Like, you still have an hour of music to write in the next 2 weeks. Like, you just can't. So you find that you just start getting very fast and very sort of confident with what you're writing. And when I go back and I listen to those scores, which I actually haven't done in many, many years, but if I were to, I think I would be surprised by some of the things that I accidentally or inadvertently found musically. And I don't think you get to those places without that level of pressure, because if you have time and space to sort of second guess, you end up discarding those ideas before they even are allowed to kind of flourish and bloom. But in the case of one of these, you know, pot boiler situations, you just kind of have to go with it. And even if it's like not working, you kind of just stick some wrenches in it and twist some screws, and then suddenly you kind of force it to work. And it makes for interesting music. And it there's always a sense of intensity to those scores, because they're all written under like extreme duress. So it's like, it's kind of cool. But, you know, I mean, I was never like a huge guy, you know, I don't really like know those movies very well, but I have to say that some of those films were very well made. It was a production company that was based in, I think, Lafayette, Louisiana. And some of the films were shot on like 35 millimeter, and they had real fantastic crews, production crews down there. And so, I mean, you know, for what those movies are, I think they're kind of definitely interesting little projects that I've worked on. I kind of have a special place in my heart for them, because they kind of taught me a lot of the tricks and the technique that I utilize every day now when I work on, you know, bigger films or whatever. You know, it's a lot of stuff comes from that experience. So it's always going to be, a special place in my heart for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think working in TV is certainly a bit of a trial by fire if you've kind of been used to doing larger feature things, and then suddenly, particularly, I mean, full network series TV is I mean, the turnarounds can be insane. So it's a good way of like seeing what you're made of, I guess.
No, absolutely. And that's the real, where the rubber meets the road. If you can handle a network series and come out of that with still intact, that's something to be proud of for sure.
Totally. So last couple of questions. Firstly, what are you doing next, if you can talk about it, which I know is not always the case?
Yeah, we've been working for the last 5 months on a feature, and, you know, can't really talk about that right now.
Right.
But that's been all consuming for the first half of this year. But next week, I'm going to New York for the Sports Emmys, actually. I was nominated for an HBO series I scored last year called Being Serena.
Right, yeah, yeah.
That was about Serena Williams, and it was a really intimate kind of portrayal of her personal life. She had taken some time away from tennis and she was becoming a mother. And so that was exciting, and I was very thrilled to get that nomination. So I'll be there for that. And then I have another project coming up with HBO later this year, which is still in the works. And then we have some more films coming up. Marco and I are going to be working together on some other things in the pipeline. I think Quiet Place is talking about maybe doing a sequel to that.
Right.
And some other things. So it's going to be pretty busy the second half of the year as well. But I'm hoping to try and take a little time off at some point. Really haven't had a day off in about 3 years. So
yeah,
taking some time off. And also I'm building a new studio at my new house in Sherman Oaks. So I'll keep the studio here in Burbank, and I'll have a home studio, which will be nice.
Cool.
You know, when those late hours kick in, I can spend some more time and be closer with my family. I have a wife and daughter there, so it'd be good to, you know, sometimes we get into these crazy schedules and just sort of disappear.
Might actually recognize you when you walk through the door then.
Exactly. That's exactly. I want to make sure my daughter still knows what I look like. So probably good to be closer to home sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So last couple of questions. First one is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Well, this is going to be very disappointing to your listeners, because I am one of those few people who actually doesn't watch a lot of TV. And it's not because I don't love it. It's because I just don't have time. I'm literally like, I spend 12 to 15 hours a day, usually 6, sometimes 7 days a week, you know, in my studio in front of screens, multiple screens, scoring TV and scoring film. So recreationally, I don't really tend to watch it. Having said that, I love Black Mirror. I don't know even if that's in the middle of a current iteration, but I think that's a brilliant series.
It is. In actual fact, they've just released a trailer. It's coming back. I want to say June, July, something like that. It's back. So 3 more episodes.
That's awesome. And my wife and I like to watch, we have these like guilty pleasure, like cooking shows that we'll watch.
So, right, yeah.
Like she likes to watch the British baking show. And, you know, there's a series called Street Food right now that, focuses on different cities in Asia and different like Asian street food, which is really exciting. I love stuff like that. And in terms of like narrative dramas, I tend not to get too into it. I missed the Game of Thrones bandwagon like way, way back. And at this point, I'm so far behind that I'm officially just saving it for my retirement, because I don't think I'll ever catch up. And then, oh yeah, and then Marco and our other colleague Brandon just have been working on the Twilight Zone reboot for CBS All Access. So I've been kind of checking that out too. And I think they're doing a really amazing job with that score. And I think Jordan's doing a really cool job with the reboot. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool too.
Awesome. Last question is, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or something future, which show would it be?
Man, that's a great question. I mean, I have to say, and again, I haven't followed Game of Thrones because I missed out at the beginning, and now I haven't caught up. But I think that Ramin is probably having a great time on that series.
Yeah.
It just seems like the idea of taking something in that fantasy world and serializing it, but at such a high level of quality so that the music can sort of be like that would be sort of a composer's dream, I think, a show like that.
Yeah.
A lot of my, you know, a lot of the scores that really inspired me when I was young, like in my early teens, you know, they were like the fantasy scores. I was like James Horner wrote this amazing score for Willow, which is like that George Lucas produced film. But yeah, and it's like it's just such a great score. I think it turns out a lot of it is sort of derivative of certain like classical music, but it's just such a beautiful score and deftly wrought. There's a couple action sequences in that. They're just amazing. And the fantasy genre just allows you to take this orchestrational color to kind of the next level. And so the idea of being able to do that on a show would be amazing. When I was really into Lost, I thought Michael did a really good job with that score and keeping it kind of primal and simplistic. But you know, this is such a hard question. I wish I had been prepped. I would have come up with three get answers.
You mentioned Willow there. There is a Willow TV show possibly on the cards. Disney Plus are in talks with Ron Howard about
doing
a Willow TV series. So
I have to call my agent to see if
Yeah. And then, of course, there's a Lord of the Rings series coming on Amazon. And if you want big fantasy things, and they're all trying to find the next Game of Thrones now. So, you know.
Of course. I know. And then that's the bummer is it'll reach the saturation point very quickly now because everyone's going to kind of try to do it. But who knows? Maybe there'll be some really great alternatives as well. So we'll see.
It's been lovely chatting with you. It's been really nice having you on.
You too, Dave. Absolutely.
Good luck with everything. Once you know what stuff's coming up and what you can actually talk about, you'll have to come back on and tell us about whatever your next thing is.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. That sounds great.
Talk to you soon. Dave. Cheers.
Okay. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
And you, bye. So that was the interview with Miles Hankin. Hope you like that. Longshot is out in cinemas now, so you can go and find it there. Here's some highlights for next week on TV. So highlights for next week, we've got Summer of Rockets, which is a little mini series going out on BBC Two on the 22nd of May at 9 p.m. It's a Stephen Polyakov Cold War drama and stars Toby Stevens and Keely Hawes. So that could be one to watch because they're both great actors.
Yeah,
so,
they are.
So there is a trailer floating around for that, but that looks really, really good. We've got the other two, which is a comedy that's coming to E4 on the 23rd of May at 10 p.m. Aspiring actor Kerry and his sister Brooke, a former professional dancer, trying to find their place in the world while wrestling with their feelings about their 13-year-old brother Chase's sudden rise to internet fame, who's basically become a YouTube star. So that's the setup for that one. That's called The Other Two. That's 23rd of May on E4. Riviera returns for a second season. That's on Sky Atlantic. That's on 23rd of May at 9 p.m. You can't fail to have seen a trailer for that somewhere. She's Gotta Have It, season two of that comes on the 24th of May to Netflix. That's the update of Spike Lee's revolutionary debut film. That's his second season for that. What If, which comes to Netflix on the 24th of May. This is a neo-noir social thriller which explores the ripple effects of what happens when acceptable people started doing unacceptable things. It sort of feels a bit Indecent Proposal-y sort of setup to this. From what I can tell from the trailer, but looks like an interesting one, that one. But that's 24th of May that starts. Then we've got Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which comes back on the 26th of May at 9 p.m. That is back fairly quickly, actually, after the US, compared to how E4 have been acting recently. Sixth season of that is back. If you're wondering what's happening to Gotham, because that's the Gotham time slot at the moment, it's moving to 10 p.m. from this week. So Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at 9, Gotham at 10. So that's a good evening's viewing. And then Crashing, which is back for its third season on Sky Atlantic. That's 27th of May at 11 p.m. That's Judd Apatow back in the comedy following a sweet but potentially unlucky comedian as he crashes on the couches of some of New York's top comics after his marriage falls apart. So that's back for its third season on the 27th on Sky Atlantic. And that's everything for this week, unless you've got anything else you want to add or mention?
Nope, that's pretty much all I've got to say. Just apart from, obviously, keep your eyes peeled on Hollywood News Source and our YouTube page over the weekend.
Yes.
So we'll be getting up, just like Dave, we'll be getting our con coverage up as soon as possible.
Yes.
And we'd love for you to see it.
Yeah. So Hollywood News Source for that. And also check out geektown.co.uk for that, because we'll have stuff going up over the week from MCM Comic Con. And I'll also have, hopefully, some stuff from the Good Omens premiere as well next week. So that's stuff to look out for. You can also visit geektown.co.uk for all your air date information over the next week. Get in touch with your questions and comments by emailing us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, where we'll have a lot of stuff going up over the con, and Instagram on Geektown UK, and we'll have a lot of cosplay photos going up on there, I suspect, over the next week or so. So go and check all that out. That's everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.